Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
And good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to RightStream Tuesday. This is your host, Daria Ann. I am a writer, ghostwriter, blogger, social media marketer, internet radio host, and founder of the RightStream Radio Network here on Blog Talk Radio. And I'm coming at you today from the beautiful Central Florida East Coast, on the beach here in Brevard County, or close to the beach. It's another beautiful day right now, but for anyone that's familiar with Florida in the summertime, let's just say I'm going to enjoy the sunshine while it's out and hope that my internet connection stays strong throughout the broadcast. But anyway, I hope you all had a wonderful Independence Day. I know I certainly did. One of the many things I did over this past weekend was to go and see the fabulous new movie, America, by Dinesh D'Souza. And I cannot say enough about it. If you have not seen this film, please, please go. Take your friends, take your family, anyone you know, especially anyone who's been afflicted by what D'Souza correctly calls America shaming. Anyone you know that is not proud of their country or who's been negatively impacted by progressivism, whether through school or pop culture or the media, please take them to see this film. It is phenomenal. You can find my review of D'Souza's America at theamericanjournal.com. That's the-american-journal.com, where I also have a feature of my good friend and fellow activist Kirsten Lombard. Kirsten is just an amazing individual. She has started a company called Resounding Books. It's a new publishing company, and they are about to release their first book entitled Common Ground on Common Core. And what's unique about Kirsten's book, which is a collection of essays, is that there are contributors from all across the political spectrum. She has managed, you know, without compromising her own principles, Kirsten has managed to just do just that, find common ground with people on important issues, including Common Core. And this book will be released, I believe, in September, and they are taking pre-orders very shortly. But if you'd like to learn more about Kirsten, check out my interview with her at American Journal. And again, that's the-american-journal.com, or hyphen if you prefer. But you can find, I just posted part two of my interview with her this morning, so please check that out. Also, check out rightstreamradio.com, because we have a great lineup of shows. We are all about diversity here at RightStream Radio, diversity of thought, that is. And so you'll find an array of shows designed to pique the interest of various people, you know, various demographics. We have Just Believe on Sunday evenings with Lisa Tarvez. Lisa is a holistic health practitioner and metaphysician. Military Monday, every Monday at 1 p.m. with author and military historian John D. Gresham. Of course, RightStream Tuesday with yours truly and a diverse array of authors. In all kinds of genres. And then on Wednesday evenings at 7 p.m. Eastern, Dr. Billy Eisenberg, who is a licensed clinical psychologist, and family law attorney Sheena Benjamin Wise co-host a call-in program called Family Power Hour. And they delve into really a specific aspect of life and of family life every week. And they invite you to call in. It's not an advice show, although they do bring on an expert guest in a particular area every week. But it's pretty informal, and they welcome you to call in and ask questions and also share your best practices. And then on Friday evenings at 7 p.m. Eastern, Lisa Tarvez and I co-host a fun women's lifestyle show called Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss. And that's sort of a little bit of a departure from from the other shows. And Lisa and I, we just have a good time, and we just take on different topics. And, you know, some of them are serious, but we take a lighthearted approach to it. And so that you can check that out every Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern here on the RightStream Radio Network. But again, if you are interested in biographies and information on all of our hosts, visit rightstreamradio.com. And before I introduce my fabulous guest for today, I want to give a shout out to author Shlomo Atiyah. His debut novel, Steps to Salvation, was released last month, and we had a book launch event down at Tropical Acres in Fort Lauderdale over the weekend. We had a great turnout. I want to thank everyone who came out to support the book, who purchased the book. Shlomo did a lot of book signing, gave a great presentation. We had professional photos taken, which you can view on his Facebook page, Shlomo Atiya Author. There's also a forthcoming video of his remarks to the audience, which was very, very interesting and included a Q&A session. And as soon as I have access to that video, I will be posting it on Shlomo's blog and, you know, all over social media. He's also on Twitter and on Pinterest, Shlomo Atiya. And you can check out his blog, shlomoatiya.wordpress.com. All right, well, I am so happy. Oh, one other quick thing before I introduce my very patient guest. Starting today, we have a new feature in the second hour of Right Stream Tuesday called the Right Wing Riot, and that will be starring authors Griff Griffith, Jamie K. Wilson, and Kia Hebe, all of whom have been guests many times on Right Stream. And I'm just so thrilled that that they suggested or they asked if we could have this segment in the second hour every week on Right Stream Tuesday, because it really gives me an opportunity to allow some other voices to take the stage and to really grow our listenership and add something new to this show every week. So Right Wing Riot will be airing beginning at 2 o'clock Eastern every week starting today on Right Stream Tuesday. All right, everyone. Well, as I mentioned, I have just an outstanding guest lined up for today. I mean, she is an incredible high achiever, a wonderful person, smart, talented. She writes fiction and nonfiction, I believe. And I'm going to go ahead and just read her bio, and then I'm going to bring her on and allow her to tell us about her background and her work in her own words. But she is author Alexandra Swan, and I'm going to read a little bit from her bio on Goodreads, where you can also find her. In 1986, Alexandra Swan graduated at 15 years of age with a bachelor's degree in liberal arts from Brigham Young University and a GPA of 3.85. The following year, when she was 16, she received a master's degree in history from California State University. After graduation, she taught history and English as a second language for 4 years at El Paso Community College. In 1989, her book, No Regrets, How Homeschooling Earned Me a Master's Degree at Age 16, was published, in which she details her experiences with homeschooling. For 15 years, from 1998 through 2013, Alexandra was self-employed in the financial services industry in El Paso, Texas. As a small business owner who was active in the community and on various civic boards, she learned firsthand the challenges that excessive regulations create for small businesses. In 2012, she received the SBA's Regional Minority Small Business Champion of the Year Award. In 2010, Alexandra and her mother incorporated Frontier 2000 Media Group to produce clean, wholesome, inspirational entertainment for families. She re-released No Regrets with a new foreword to the 20th Century Anniversary edition of the book, updating readers on what her family is doing today. She is also co-author of 4 Christian fiction novels, including The Fourth Kingdom, which was selected as one of 4 finalists in the Christianity Today 2011 Christian Fiction Book Awards. Her newest solo novel, The Planner, about the dangerous consequences of overreaching progressive federal government, was released on June 28, 2012. So it is with great pleasure that I welcome author Alexandra Swan to Right Stream Tuesday.
Hi, it's so good to be with everybody. And I was talking to Daria. Daria and I were talking a little bit before the show. We've known each other through social media a long time, but we never actually spoken until today. Only in the 21st century is that even possible. So we live in great times.
Yes, we do. And, you know, and Alexandra, I think one of the best benefits as authors is the ability to publish your work independently and then use those platforms to kind of get your work out there. But, you know, before we get into all of that, I know I read your amazing bio, but tell us a little bit about yourself in your own words, Alexandra. And I want to get – I think you're the first guest I've ever brought on the air who was actually homeschooled with incredible results. So if you could speak to that a little bit, too, and just let our listeners know what that was like and why homeschooling is so important.
Well, you know, I was very blessed. My mother started homeschooling me in 1975. That kind of gives everybody an idea of how old I am. I was 5 years old, so you could do the math. But it was, you know, homeschool, the word didn't exist. The word has not been coined yet. So we went through accredited correspondence schools, but all the work was done at home. So when people would ask us, where do you go to school, my mother would say, well, tell them you go to a private school. But we were really small. We did go to a private school. We were enrolled in Calvert School, a school that the State Department used, and it was also the school that a lot of foreign mission boards used. And my dad's attorney had actually found it for them. So we would, you know, we would do all of our work. My mother would check our tests, and they were sent to the school to make sure that we did everything we were supposed to do, and everything. We had great transcripts. We had everything. But she would say, tell them that it's private. And so, you know, you go to a private school. So we would say, you know, well, that's private. And then people would think, well, they mean it's personal. And then we were being unfriendly. And so, you know, it's kind of a very odd dynamic. We didn't know anybody who homeschooled. I was 14 years old before we met another family that homeschooled. So it's a very, very different life. There were 10 of us. I'm the oldest of 10 children. We lived in the country. We had a big family. And we went to school at home. But it was a wonderful way to grow up. We had a wonderful teacher. My mother's a very dynamic person. She's really capable of doing so many wonderful things. And we were very blessed to have her as a teacher, very blessed for the things that we learned. We went to school year-round, summer and winter. So that's why we ended up so accelerated. We did not skip any grades. I went through every single grade, first grade through high school. And I have a high school diploma from the American School of Chicago, Illinois, which is also a terrific school. So we never skipped anything. The purpose was not to be accelerated. The purpose was she thought that kids waste time in the summer. They get bored, and that's true. And so we went to school year-round. We had Saturday and Sunday off. We'd have whatever federal holidays my dad took off from work, and the rest of the time we were in school learning. And it was rigorous, but our typical school day was about 3.5 hours, and of course it got longer as I got older. When I was 12 years old, I finished high school. And it had all been done at home, so my parents weren't quite sure what to do with me, and they wanted me to go to college. But, you know, I was obviously 12 years old. I had an opportunity through the headmaster of the American school to possibly enter a Johns Hopkins program for gifted young people, but I would have had to go live in Baltimore, Maryland. And my family lived in El Paso, Texas, so that's a long way away. So my parents rejected that idea, and through a lot of prayer and searching, they found a program through Brigham Young University that was an external degree program. It was a distance learning program, and at that time there was no internet. Distance learning meant you did it through the mail. So, but it was similar to what we had been doing, and it was a very cutting-edge program. BYU, because it is a Mormon university, the LDS faith really stresses education, and they want everybody to get an education. So this program had been designed for older people who had never had a chance to get their degrees because marriage or life or work or whatever had happened to them. So the program was set up really well. The professors who taught at BYU also administered this program. And several of the professors said this was actually one of the most demanding programs they had because they demanded a lot out of you. It was a liberal arts degree. I got enrolled in that, and I was the youngest student ever to graduate from BYU, and it's 111-year history. And when I was 15 years old, I had spent a total of 11 weeks on campus, but everything had been done through all the professors. I did graduate with a very high GPA. And then through the recommendation of the director of the program, I entered California State University at Dominguez Hills in Carson, California, which was another excellent program. I got my Master of Arts in the Humanities through that program, and I graduated when I was 16 years old. So I have an MA in the Humanities, and I have spent a total of 11 weeks on a campus doing that. As I say, it was very, very different. The BYU program that I went through doesn't even really exist anymore. It's been discontinued. They went with other distance learning type things. I am not Mormon, for people who are out there wondering, but I did have a wonderful experience at the school, and it was a lot to be said for it. It's a very different life. It's a very unusual life, but we had a very good life growing up, and I owe a lot to my parents for giving me those opportunities.
That is fantastic, and my gosh, yes, my hat is off to your parents, and especially your mom raising all those children and homeschooling, so she sounds like a wonderful lady.
She is a wonderful lady. She's very disciplined. She's very hardworking. She homeschooled all 10 of her children using the same school, And she got them all out of school in their teens, you know, as master's degrees. And you know, I wrote the book because I was 16 years old and I had a master's degree and I didn't quite know what to do with myself. So she said, well, write a book about it. So she did. We published it and we sold about 5,000 copies of it. This was began many years ago. This book came out in 1989. So it was a long time before digital publishing and all these kinds of things. We had physical paperback copies. But that book opened the door for us to start speaking at homeschool conventions and to travel, and we were in Paul Harvey's radio show. We were in National Enquirer. They say nothing in the choir is true. Well, some of it's true. Our story was true. And we were in Woman's World. We were on the 700 Club. We were on a really short-lived CBS series called How They Do That, about families that did remarkable things. So it opened a huge number of doors, and people will say, well, you know, everybody did the same thing at your house. Yeah, we did. There were 10 of us. She had 10 children in 12 years. She homeschooled them all. She got them all master's degrees. It was very streamlined. If it hadn't been streamlined, it wouldn't have worked. But she's an amazing, amazing person. Gets up early every morning still, cleans her own house, worked for years, all kinds of various things, wonderful author, wonderful grandmother, wonderful mother, just an amazing person.
Yeah, and well, and it sounds like, Alexandra, your family typifies the American spirit of self-reliance that seems to be missing in our culture today. So, I mean, congratulations, and I'm just so happy, you know, to have you on the show today to be able to talk about these things.
Well, thank you. I mean, one of the things that my parents did teach us was self-reliance. You know, your problems are not other people's fault, and everybody has problems. My mother used to tell us that when we would find everybody has problems, everybody has difficulties. And we had a lot of difficulties growing up. You know, we had a lot of financial problems. We had a lot of all kinds of problems, health problems, not me personally, but people in my family had health problems. And there were a lot of things that happened over the course of everybody's life. And one of the things that they taught us was, you know, stuff happens to people. Push forward. It's not everybody else's fault. And even if it's not your fault, it's still your problem. And I really believe that. I tell people that today. I think one of the things missing in our country is we have adapted "it's not my fault" as a get-out-of-jail-free card. A lot of stuff in life is not your fault. It's still your problem. And we've got a lot of things in this country today that are not our fault personally, but they're our problem. We have to deal with fixing them.
Absolutely. And that mentality has been exploited and even fostered, I would submit, by politicians in both parties. I would say the permanent political class that benefits from a dependency mindset. I mean, would you say that that's an accurate description of what's going on?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, you teach people that something is not their fault, or even if it is their fault, they shouldn't have to deal with it. They're a victim. They're a victim of somebody. They're a victim of society. They're a victim of the economy. They're a victim of whatever. And then you take away their responsibility to fix anything that is a problem. And then you create dependency, and from dependency you create big government and control. And that's really what the planner is about. You mentioned the planner. The planner is about what happens when you create dependency and then you create control to fix the dependency. And I really see, you know, I'm very encouraged by the Tea Party movement. I'm very encouraged by Dinesh D'Souza's movie America, which I saw this weekend too. It is a wonderful movie. I'm encouraged by the success of that movie. Everybody in America should go see that movie. But I'm also very aware that we have a whole class of people growing up of all races, creeds, colors, who are really bought and sold with the idea that the government is my parent. The government is my husband. The government is my master. The government is my caretaker. And it is the government and society's job to take care of me. A lot of people believe that today, and it's a scary thing.
Oh, yeah, it certainly is. And Alexandra, before we move further, I just want to let our listeners know, if you want to call in with your questions and comments for Alexandra, the phone number is 347-945-7246. Or, you know, I see we've got some guests in the chat room. If you'd like to type your question in, if you're too shy to call in and you have a question for Alexandra, type it in and I will certainly ask her on the air. So, Alexandra, let's get into a little bit of the planner. Tell us a little bit about the plot of that story and how it came about.
Okay. Let me talk about how it came about before I tell you the plot. I was a mortgage broker for 15 years. I started my own business in 1998 with a little bitty savings. My dad and I were partners, and we had to work like crazy. It was very, very, very hard work. At the time that I started that business, You did not have to have a license in Texas to be a mortgage broker. All you had to do was hang out a shingle. But there was a lot of competition. You had to work very, very hard to get started. And, you know, we were by ourselves. We weren't part of a big company. It was really literally about $10,000 in an IRA. That's what we had. That was it. So with that, we had to pay our office. We had to do everything. And it was very, very hard work. And we built it. We worked on this company, got networked, got to know people. That's why I was on so many boards, is that I had gotten to know so many people in the community to build the business. And it, as the real estate market took off, I would say after 2001, the real estate market really began to explode because interest rates went down after 9/11. And that's really what precipitated the big boom in real estate. So as it began to grow, and of course the business was growing, and I saw, you know, all of these things happening. Our company was growing. It was getting bigger. My mother was actually working at the company, and she owned part of the company, and she used to tell me they've got all these crazy products now that don't make any sense. And one of them, for example, was that Wells Fargo had a product, but there, a lot of people had a version of this, where you could qualify a person to buy their first home, and part of the qualification was they had to have income they could not prove. So they could tell you, I fix cars for on the side. You know, I have a regular job, but I fix cars on the side, and I make $500 a month. And you could use that as additional income. But the caveat was they could not have filed that income anywhere. There could not be any proof that income existed. Because if there were proof it existed, you couldn't use it. It just didn't make sense. And you know, it was there were all of these forces working in the markets to put 5 million additional people in houses. So this is the Bush initiative. 5 million new Americans were going to go in homes who'd never owned homes before. They were going to be good citizens, and everything was going to be wonderful, and it was going to make neighborhoods stronger, and it was going to make America stronger. Well, we know what happened at the end of that. The real estate market crashed. The banking industry crashed. Lehman Brothers crashed. By the fall of 2007, it was just like a domino effect. They started going out in 2006, the lenders did. By August of 2007, we were getting bankruptcy notices every day from different lenders who were closing their doors. Some of them had been some of the most active, the ones that had marketed the most. They had sold all these crazy products, and they started going bankrupt. Well, that was not really a huge surprise if you were in the industry. But what was a surprise was how fast it spread and how far-reaching it spread. And I began watching this saying, good grief. You know, this, we knew we were expecting a correction. We knew there was a correction coming. But not this. This is a total meltdown. And then, of course, in 2008, Barack Obama came in. And then in 2009 and 2010, we saw the Dodd-Frank bill, which passed in 2010. And I began looking at this bill, and I thought, this is not about preventing another Wall Street collapse, which is what it was sold as. It was the Wall Street Reform Act, supposedly to keep this from happening again. This is about, it's a huge bill. It's thousands of pages. But the part that had to do with mortgages, this is about keeping Americans from buying homes. And home ownership is a mainstay of America. That's been the American dream. Why would anybody want to keep Americans from buying homes? So I began researching. I began writing a blog about it. And I still write this blog. It's called Protection Money. And the idea behind it is, you know, you pay the government to protect you. It's just exactly like paying protection money to the mob. They're extorting money from you. You're not going to get anything from it. So my blog is protectionmoney.blogspot.com, and I started writing about Dodd-Frank. I started reading Dodd-Frank. I started writing about Dodd-Frank. And as I delved into it deeper and deeper, I thought, I don't get this. This is about destroying home ownership in America. And then late 2010, because that was, of course, when the House flipped, when the Tea Party just was getting started, and that they turned over the House back to the Republicans and kicked out Pelosi. Just before that happened, Chris Dodd introduced a new bill. It's called the Livable Communities Act. And when I read that bill, it was very short. It did not pass, but it was supposed to be his legacy. When I read that bill, I thought, okay, this is what this is about. Livable Communities was about creating dense urban style housing, putting everybody in public transportation, getting rid of single family home ownership, and putting everybody in densely packed inner cities. And that's when I started finding out about a UN initiative in 1992 called Agenda 21. Agenda 21 was about, it was passed through the UN. It was never ratified by the U.S. Senate. It was signed by George H.W. Bush. It's a soft treaty. So it's not really enforceable, but it is being enacted all throughout the country. And it is a UN initiative to put people in densely packed human settlements, and that is the term that they use in Agenda 21, to release and rewild a lot of the United States to the wildlands, to wild animals, So it'd be sort of like national forests, except you can't camp overnight. And there'd be huge swaths of the United States would be there. To put everybody in public transportation, that's why we see such an attack of oil in this country. That's why Barack Obama would not approve the Keystone Pipeline, is they don't want cheap energy. They don't want people using oil. And Al Gore had said in order to change people's driving habits, you've got to get gas prices up to a minimum of $6 a gallon. So this is the goal, is to put everybody in sort of to Manhattanize America, to use the phrase that Stanley Kurtz uses a lot, to put everybody in dense housing, public transportation, take away private property, pack people in on top of each other, and then you're able to control them. And another part of this that people don't like to talk about, but it is part of it, is to reduce the population dramatically from 7 billion people to about 1 billion people eventually. And people like Ted Turner will actually say this. He's on YouTube. He'll actually talk about this, that there are too many people and the climate's going to heat up 30 to 40 degrees and we're all going to become cannibals. He said that in a YouTube interview. So these are some of the issues. And as I began looking at this and understanding this, I thought, okay, how can we present this in a way that people can understand? Because I was writing this blog. Dodd-Frank is a very dry bill. And then I was driving one day. I was going down to FedEx on a Saturday, and I got this idea for a story. Because the other huge problem that people were finding out at that time, this is in early 2011, the other huge problem was how to reform Social Security and Medicare. So I got this idea. What if the government got rid of Social Security and Medicare? Didn't phase it out, just got rid of it. Said there's no more Social Security, there's no more Medicare. Instead, you're going to trade everything you own to us, and we're going to take care of you. How many people would go along with that? So in that 45-minute car ride, I got this complete concept for the planner. I had all the major characters except Dr. Michael Lynn. He was added later. But to tell this story through one family of what happens, the main character, Chris Mitchell, is a real estate agent. So I can tell through her story of having built her business, having lost her business. Her ex-boyfriend is a mortgage broker, very successful. When the market goes down, he dumps her. She's alone. She doesn't have anybody. She can't get a job. She looks for a job everywhere. And then this opportunity comes along to be a planner in a new government community for seniors. And the government's going to get rid of all the Social Security, and they're going to get rid of all the Medicare, and everybody's going to sign all their property over to the government, everybody over 65, your 401k, your house, your car, everything. And the government's going to take care of you for as long as you live for the rest of your life. They're going to take care of your health care, your housing, all of your needs, everything that's an issue for you. You don't have to worry about anything. It's worry-free living. And so Chris becomes the saleswoman for this project. And she sells it to a lot of people. She sells it to her own parents. And what happens, what that leads to, what happens when you do that?
Wow. Sounds very, very frightening. But Alexander, you definitely make a great point, and this is why I promote and am part of the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance, because I believe, you know, in today's world, and with these long, dry, like you said, boring bills, people aren't going to read them. So there's so much value in entertaining while informing. Now, let me ask you, in the book, in the planner, does Chris at first, she doesn't understand exactly what's going on or why this is so frightening,
no.
And scary, but okay.
She doesn't understand this at all. You know, Chris, I made Chris as much of just a regular American as I thought I possibly could. You know, she's worked very hard. She's been working since the day she got out of college. Her parents worked very hard. Her father was a builder. Her grandfather owned mobile home communities all through Arizona. Her father was a builder. They were all very successful. Her brother works for cable news network. He's been very successful, but different things have happened to each of them to cause them to lose that money. She's always worked. She's never expected anything from anybody. She had this long-term relationship with this guy who's now gone. No, she doesn't understand what's wrong with this. She's looking at it saying, you know, my house got foreclosed on, which, you know, that's the first chapter of the book. Her house has gotten foreclosed on, and she's been looking for work, and she just has to get this job. And she's looking at it saying, everything is gone. But if I can do this, if I can get this job, things are going to start to get better. And maybe it's a good idea to have the government take care of you. And she has to sell this to her own parents. Her parents are much more conservative than she is. She has to go, she has to talk to them, and they're very opposed to it. But they do it anyway because they don't have any choice. And, you know, when I promote the book, I say those who trade liberty for security deserve neither and lose both. But my mother said about it, really, it's not even about deserve neither. It's about they just lose both. These are hardworking people. They're honest people. They're very representative of who middle-class America is. They've never taken anything from anybody. They've always expected to work for what they got. And they've really been kicked in the teeth. And now they just want for the parents just to have some retirement, a place to go, because they can't get loans to keep their business going. They can't get anything. They're in the situation that a lot of Americans are in or have been in over the last 5 years. And so it's really a story of a lot of Americans, minus, you know, this particular government program, which thank God doesn't exist yet, but how this just, how when the government brings in these kinds of things, they sound good on the surface. But then you start getting into it, and you find that there are layers and layers and layers and layers of control. And it's been compared to 1984. It's been compared to Agenda 21 by Glenn Beck. It's been compared to a lot of these things, but it's got great reviews on it, and it is scary. People who read it say it's very scary. I have reread it quite a few times, but it is scary. It's a scary scenario about what happens when you let the government take over everything.
Yeah, but you know, people need to understand, you know, and need to be made aware of what happens when you allow the government to control everything. And it's funny you brought up Agenda 21, because I've interviewed Harriet Park, who co-authored that book, several times. And you know, when you were talking, Alexandra, about how, you know, Agenda 21 and big government and the UN and their initiative is to drive Americans into these tiny, cramped spaces, I recall not too long ago, and I don't listen to him every day. It's not because I don't like him. It's just because sometimes I have to take a break from talk radio because I get so infuriated about what's going on. But Rush Limbaugh was talking about this, I believe, about 6 months ago on his show, you know, that they don't trust you and I and everyday Americans to take care of the animals. And as Harriet Park has often said, too, Agenda 21 just completely flips the Christian worldview on its head, where, you know, God
yes.
has given man dominion over the animals. So,
yes.
Frightening.
Yes. Well, and this is really Gaia worship. And, you know, we wrote the planner. I wrote the planner, and then Mother and I co-wrote The Chosen, because we've co-written a lot of things together. We've solo written, we've co-written. The Chosen, we take on, actually, the NSA indefinite detention and the problem of indefinite detention in American citizens without trial. So it's got the same characters, but it goes in a different direction. We take on another issue. Well, we wrote another book after that called The Force, which is the sequel to The Fourth Kingdom that you mentioned, but you read the bio. And we talk a lot about this same issue, but we talk about it from another level. We talk about it from the level of the people in charge. And in The Force, the antagonist is a member of the Club of Rome, which is a real organization. And we talk about Gaia worship, and we talk about earth worship and nature worship. And that's really what is at the heart of them. This is built as something new and modern, but really it's something very ancient, it's something very pagan, that really, really seeks to put the earth at the center of everything instead of the Christian God as at the center of everything. And it's a totally different perspective. When you start getting into serious earth worship, which is totally different from, you know, I don't think we should just cut down trees willy-nilly, but you get into earth worship, you have a real formula for mass genocide, because people become the enemy, and it's very dangerous. A lot of people do not understand that. I just moved to Dallas, Texas. I love the Dallas area, but everything here is about sustainability, 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 recycling. You know, as a Christian, we believe and we know from the Bible that God made everything and that we are supposed to protect what he made and be good stewards of it. But this push towards sustainability that you see everywhere, that's about something else. That's about a worldview that includes communism and that does not have and complete government control and totalitarianism, and that does not have much of a role in it for people.
No, it doesn't. I mean, history proves that. You know, as you just said, and it's funny, you know, you mentioned communism and totalitarianism. I mean, Stalin became an atheist. Hitler, I believe, became an atheist. And the first thing they did was remove God, you know, especially, you know, the Christian God, from the public square, well, along with guns and the right to bear arms. But it's so true, and that's what's so scary. You know, when they use words like sustainable, like the average person, when you hear that word, well, who doesn't want to sustain things, you know, good things?
Right.
And that's what's so frightening. I think it's vocabulary. You know, people that don't think words matter words do matter. I remember, you know, back in the day when I used to listen to Tony Robbins, he talked about quote-unquote transformational vocabulary, and, you know, that is what we're seeing with respect to what's going on right now. And, Alexander, I had a question because you mentioned population control, and I wanted to get your opinion on this, because as soon as you were talking about that, I thought back to 1973 and Roe versus Wade. In your research or in your opinion, does that Supreme Court decision have a lot to do with population control?
Yes, it does. It has a lot to do with population control. First of all, you cannot implement the kind of control that Agenda 21 calls for without controlling the population. And second of all, if you really look at, and on my website, which is frontier2000.net, I have a page at the back that has video clips, but it also has a link to some other websites, some green websites, that define some of these terms. There, if you read the quotes from these different people who are really deeply into this, and unfortunately most of the leaders of the, quote, free world, as well as the not free world, believe in this. They believe in this concept of Gaia worship, of sustainability, that's called smart growth. Who doesn't want to be in favor of smart growth? You know, you do want to be dumb? No, of course not. Everyone wants to be smart. So, you know, they have named it, and as my brother often says, if you name something, you own it. So, you know, you get to control the message. But, yes, population control is a huge part of this. And Prince Philip has said that if he's, the royal family of England is very much into this green, sustainable, new age kind of concept. And he has said if he could do one thing, one service for mankind, he would come back as a deadly disease to wipe out a lot of the population. So,
oh my
that kind
God.
Of gives you an idea. Yeah, that's an actual quote from him. There's no place for people. I've read statistics from 500 million to a billion people is all the people they want, and there are a little over 7 billion, and they're going to be about 9 billion by 2050. And just FYI, the goal date for getting a lot of this stuff in place completely is 2050, with a 2020 goal date for getting parts of it in place. So we are really at a crossroads in this country. I mean, you know, what are we going to do as a country? Are we going to continue to embrace big government, totalitarian ideals, or are we going to say no? We believe in the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible values liberty. He values freedom. He values individuality. He values individuals. Values people. He made people in his image, and they have value because they are made by him, and not because of how much education they have or what they know or what they can do or what they contribute to society. They have value because they're made by him in his image. Whichever one of those we choose is going to determine what happens to us as a country.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's why it is so important for, you know, authors like yourself and the CLFA and everyone who loves this country, you know, D'Souza, I mean, I could, to really, you know, I'm so thankful for people like you who are producing works of fiction. But I want to get your take on this too, Alexandra. I mean, I get a little frustrated by the lack of understanding by deep-pocketed people on our side, meaning people who could build a movie studio, who could build a huge publishing company that could rival whatever else is out there. I get very frustrated by their resistance. I don't know, maybe they're resisting, maybe they just don't know, maybe they don't want to know. They don't seem to understand that culture is politics, and that really, we're dealing with a cultural problem here. And I guess, you know, it would be so nice if talented authors like yourself and everybody that's involved in the movement, if we had people that understood that and really could put some big dollars behind it. I know D'Souza, I mean, his production was fantastic. I mean, the production values were wonderful with his film. But I know that they mentioned in an interview when they were doing 2016, it was difficult to get the funding to make a decent film, you know, production quality-wise, that people would want to see. I mean, so I guess that's a frustration that I have. I mean, do you think that tide is turning, and how do you feel about that?
Well, I think, first of all, if we do not take back the media, we cannot take back our culture. We can't, because our culture is a media-driven culture. The media has been at work for 40 years on this, so this is critical. I was watching my 6-year-old nephew, he's one of the reasons I wanted to move to Dallas. But my 6-year-old nephew's here, and I was watching him, and we were trying to find something to watch on Nickelodeon. So we turned on Dora the Explorer. The entire episode was about sustainability. They are going to win the science fair by building a green energy project using heat from a volcano to heat and provide all the electricity for a small village. But then, of course, at the end, they let the volcano blow up, and isn't that fun? And I told him, I said, and in real life, when you build a village over a volcano, a lot of times that's what happens. It actually does blow up. And then, you know, everybody dies at the end. So this really isn't a very good idea. Of course, he didn't understand what I was talking about. But the thing is, he's six. These are the messages that are being drilled into him from all of his media that he watches, because it's coming at him from every place. He wanted a recycling truck for his birthday. And I'm not saying recycling is bad, but I am saying, you know, this is, he's got this concept already, this green concept, and all you have to do is plant the seeds and let it grow. Now, in terms of how you get stuff produced, my brothers work in the media. I have six brothers. Four of them are very active in media, and they've been very successful in it. Well, in fact, one of them is in the process now of producing a new show for syndication called Backroads Ride. It's going to be just, you know, about different places you can see in this country that are kind of off the road. So, you know, that we've done, our family knows something about this. The money drives everything. If you can make the money, you can get things done. Because the people who produce it want a return on their investment. What will help get the money is for people to support the projects that are out there. The reason D'Souza was able to get America produced is 2016 was such a huge success. The first time it's very hard. If you don't have the track record and you don't make the money, people are not going to take a risk on you, because most people, no matter what they say, do not have strong enough convictions to lose a lot of money on purpose. However, as these projects become successful, then people who have the dollars, who have the money to put into it, are likelier to say, you know what, there's an audience for it, there is a reason to do this, and we can make money on it, and we're going to do it. And then that changes everything. That changes the whole dynamic. But the money drives it. So what actually makes this possible is exactly what Susan pointed out in his movie about Matt Damon. He said Matt Damon's a star because American moviegoers go to see his movies. If you want it to work, you got to support the movies that are out there. You got to support projects like America. Buy the book. Take your kids to see the movie, especially your kids. Your kids need to see this. They need to see the alternative view of American history. Talk to them about what the real truth about America is. Support alternative media, even if it's not maybe as good a quality as you would like to see. I try to go to see everything that's conservative alternative media. Some of it I like, some of it I don't like, but I try to support it. And some of it's getting very, very good. The movie God's Not Dead came out last year, really early this year. I think it came out really early this year. Wonderful movie. Very well done. One of the best Christian movies I've ever seen. But in order to get to that level of quality, there had to be a lot of movies that came before it that weren't so good. And, you know, we support those, and we put our money into them, and then the quality improves, and then people are willing to support more movies.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that's one of the reasons why I do this, you know, this show and started the Rightstream Radio Network. And, you know, I didn't call it, you know, Conservative Network, or, you know, I called it Rightstream because it is about writing. And I, like I said, at the opening, we have, you know, diverse hosts with different opinions and different subject matter that they cover. But that's to get more people listening, so that hopefully maybe if they listen to somebody else's show, they'll tune into mine and they'll hear from wonderfully talented authors like yourself who have something important to share. But I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, I try to, you know, in the case with America, you know, I've got a review up on the websites that I write for and share it everywhere on social media and encourage people to get out there, because one of my friends who's very conservative was saying the other day, yeah, but he's preaching to the choir. And I said, well, you know what? It's up to you and me to bring people we know who either are apolitical or maybe they're liberal. Like you said, bring your children, nieces and nephews. It's up to us to get out there and support it. So I completely agree with you. And another sort of another aspect of this whole cultural battle that I want to get your take on, Alexandra, I'll tell you a little story about my Christmas shopping adventure a couple of years ago. When my nieces are a little bit older now. They're young teenagers, and the youngest one is now, she's almost 10. But several years ago, I was shopping for them for Christmas, and, you know, they were pretty young at the time. And I am telling you, I must have gone to like six or seven different department stores trying to find appropriate clothing for these little girls, and I couldn't find anything anywhere. I was so frustrated. And it just seems to me that part of this effort to divide the family and usurp the authority of parents is to sexualize these children while they're little, while they're young, and it's absolutely diabolical. But I wanted to get your opinion on that. Do you think that's happening, and what can we do to stop that?
Well, it's absolutely happening, and it's a huge problem. It's as big a problem as the other that I was talking about politicizing their cartoons and politicizing the Muppets. And, you know, you politicize their messages and you sexualize them. Glenn Beck said something, and this is not an exact quote, but this is the gist of it, is you take away people's freedom by playing to their most debased desires. And that's true. You know, when you give in to the things that are really sordid that people want, then they don't pay much attention when you're taking away all their liberties. So in terms of what we can do about that, that's something parents have to address really, really strictly. I mean, I'm really grateful for the way that my sister raises her kids. She has such good kids. She has a daughter who's 13, works really hard with them, keeps them in volleyball. I'm grateful for the ways that my parents raised us, very, very strict. We didn't even date at all until we were 18 years old. But you need to have rules. You know, if you're going to raise good kids, you need to have good rules. And rules are not popular in our society. Everybody's supposed to be everybody's pal and everybody's friend. But, you know, one thing that is destroying our society and breeding the welfare state is that people have children out of wedlock and they don't want to get married. And I understand, you know, sometimes things happen when people are young and they end up having a child. And, of course, that child is loved by God and you want to keep it and take care of it if you are able to do that. And if not, you want to find a home to adopt it to. However, this should be the exception in our society. It should not be the norm. It should not be something that we aspire to as a society. The Obama administration has won elections on the life of Julia model. If you recall a couple of years ago, Michelle Obama said, this is before 2012, for all you ladies who don't have a husband out there, my husband will be your husband. Yeah. And it was, you know, it's the same thing as, you know, if you can't afford a Christmas tree, enjoy ours, which she also said. Barack Obama cannot be everybody's husband, not that anybody would want him to be, but the whole idea is absurd. Government is not your husband. The way we fix our country is by teaching, especially young girls, because women do hold the keys to morality in society. Wait until you get married. Do not have children outside of marriage. Get a guy to marry you. Don't be sleeping with him. And build a life that makes sense, and rely on yourselves and your immediate family and your extended family. Do not rely on the government. The government is not your husband. The government cannot be your husband. The government cannot be your caretaker. And when we start getting that through to kids, then society will change. And a big part of that is you are more than how you look. You are more than how you dress. So, you know, we promote good values. We promote purity. We promote self-respect. And we promote self-initiative. And that means dressing appropriately, going to school, getting a husband, having a family in a family structure. Mitt Romney said it really great. I didn't like everything about Mitt Romney, but I loved this. He said, we need to teach people to get married before they have kids. And, you know, if we don't do that, we're not going to be able to end the welfare state. And if we can't end the welfare state, we can't end anything else. Because this is all stemming from government dependency, all of it.
Well, right, and I think that's why also the government is making it more expensive to be married. You know, because they do not, a strong family is the nucleus of a strong, prosperous, independent society, and that is the last thing they want. They want to control everything.
Yes, they do. And you can do that when you have this idea, this crazy idea we have now, especially being sold to women, you are independent if you don't have a husband. It doesn't matter if you are on all kinds of social programs, you are on all kinds of welfare. That's fine. As long as you don't have a husband, you are standing on your own two feet. Baloney. You can't have a society like that. You can't have kids growing up where their daddy is Uncle Sam and not expect to really pay the cost later in terms of freedom, in terms of opportunity, in terms of jobs. We're seeing that. We're seeing that in the last 5 years. We have got 101 million people, roughly, out of work in this country. And I read a worse statistic the other day. 20%, roughly, of American families do not have one single person who's working now. That's unsustainable. We talk about things that are sustainable. That is unsustainable. You have to get people back to work. You have to have families with both parents. You have to have a family structure that says, we value work, we value education, we value self-reliance. And self-reliance doesn't mean you don't ever go ask your brother for a loan. Self-reliance means you don't go to the government and get on food stamps.
Exactly. And also, you know, and we also uphold the idea of a strong male role models of strong men. I mean, that's another thing that they've chipped away at purposely in our culture. You know, they've purposely emasculated men in the concept of manhood. You know, to the point where, you know, pajama boy is their ideal for a man. I'm talking about the sadists, again, who want to control us all.
Yes. Yes, because pajama boy is not a threat to anybody. This is because the traditional male American, a traditional American man is the guy who works, the guy who takes care of his family, the guy who pays taxes, the guy who's responsible. That's who he is. He's not this needy, whiny victim. And he's not, you know, the guy who's down at the nail salon getting his nails done all the time. I mean, there's a place for that, I guess, and that's fine. But that's not what we think of when we think of the men who built this country. The men who built this country did not have manicures. And, you know, we need to really celebrate masculinity, genuine masculinity. Masculinity in a Christian setting. People who are responsible, people who are not violent, people who are, you know, protective of their families in a good way, people who understand freedom, people who understand liberty, people who understand individual responsibility. We need to be teaching that.
Amen. Absolutely. Alexander, my gosh, the time is going by so fast. I mean, I have to bring you back on again because I could talk, listen to you talk for hours. But, you know, we have about 4 minutes left, and I want to make sure I give you an opportunity to let people know where they can purchase your book, where they can find you online, and you know, and all of that good stuff. And you're definitely going to be welcome back here anytime, but please share that information with our audience so that you can connect with them.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I'd love to come back. This has been a blast. My website is www.frontier2000.net. My company is Frontier 2000 Media Group. And as I said, we're developing lots of projects. We have about 11 books out, including my book, No Regrets, and my mother's book about teaching us, Looking Backward, My 25 Years as a Homeschooling Mother. Where everything's available on Amazon, so you can go to Amazon.com and download anything on Kindle or in paperback. They're available as both. My blog is Protection Money. That's all one word, protectionmoney.blogspot.com. And I write that, you know, several times a week. We have Facebook. I'm on Facebook. But the Facebook for the company is Facebook.com Frontier 2000 Media Group. I'm also on Facebook just as Alexandra Swann. It's an author page. SWANN. And Twitter. Twitter for the company is Frontier_2000. And my own Twitter account is Alexandra Swann, just my name. We also have a Facebook page we do called The Liberty Project. And that's on Facebook as The Liberty Proj, Facebook.com, The Liberty Proj. It's on Twitter the same way. And you can go in there. We post every single day, multiple times during the day, all the latest and greatest conservative and libertarian news, our blogs, videos. I've done some videos about Agenda 21. So there's lots of stuff available, lots of ways to get in touch with us, keep in touch with us. We have a lot of sales for our different products, and we have a lot of new things coming out.
Well, fantastic. Well, I mean, I have completely enjoyed this interview, and as I said, I definitely want to bring you back on here as your schedule permits, Alexandra. And, you know, just so that the audience knows, our listeners, I mean, Alexandra and I, we've been Twitter friends for years, and today is the first, like we said at the beginning of the show, today's the first day I've actually spoken with her, and it's been such an honor and a privilege, and I, like I said, can't wait to bring you back on in the near future.
Thank you. I would love that.
So, all right, everybody. Well, please follow Alexandra Swann on Twitter. And, you know, if you missed all of that listing that she just gave, all the places to find her on Facebook and on social media, the show will be archived. And, Alexandra, I will be tweeting this out later so that you'll have it as well.
Wonderful. And I'll share that on my pages, too.
Sounds great. Well, thank you so much for joining me, and I look forward to having you back on here real soon.
Wonderful. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, everybody. We are going to take a quick break, and, you know, since we just celebrated Independence Day and we talked about This Is America, I think I have a very appropriate break song that I'm going to play for you right now. And then when we come back, it'll be time to start the right-wing riot. Don't go away.
the twilight lies gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight. Oh, the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming. Get the rocket ready.
Live. I was in the screening room. This is Daria. That was Madison Rising. We are waiting to join the right-wing riot here in just a few minutes, waiting for our third rioter to call in. So in the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and play a few promos here for the network, and we'll be starting the second half of the show shortly.
Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to Right Stream Radio Network for Just Believe, with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the Right Stream Radio Network.
Means it is time for the right-wing riot here on Right Stream Tuesday. Are we ready, rioters?
Yeah.
Yep.
Welcome to another edition of The Right Wing Riot with your hosts, the scary smart Jamie K. Wilson, the mysterious and alluring Ms. Always Right, and Griff Griffiths, who is the Prince of White Bread. Let's get this riot started!
Gosh, that's so nice. I just want to play that again.
We rock so hard.
Well, welcome to the Right Wing Riot. You've heard who we are, sort of, but maybe we need a few words from each of our amazing hosts about who we really are. First, let's start with Ms. Always Right, the mysterious and alluring and rarely photographed Ms. Always Right.
That's me, and because of the nature of my pseudonym, I'm not going to tell you a lot about myself.
Okay, moving right along. Well, can you tell us a little bit about why you had to assume the nom de riot, Always Right?
Because of where I live and work, I would not want to hurt anyone's feelings.
Yeah, that's
I'm
a lot
in the
more
closet.
Thoughtful.
I'm in the closet.
Okay, okay.
Did elephants fit in the closet?
It's the elephant in the room, if not in the closet.
I'm in the closet.
And how about, let's hear from the scary smart person in the room, which is not me.
Oh, God.
I guess that's supposed to be me.
It's you.
Yes, ma'am.
Admit it.
Yeah, I'm Jamie K. Wilson. I'm a military wife, mom of five, ridiculously busy because I am running the conservative counterculture from my end of the world and working for Liberty Island, which everybody should have heard of by now, and an active participant on the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance on Facebook. We are having a lot of fun doing what we're doing.
Wow, you sound like an actual insurrectionist.
I am. I believe in it. I'm a rebel. I'm from the South. I got to be a rebel.
I suppose. Okay, Ms. Wilson, can you get a little closer to your phone? You were a little muted there.
Oh, that must be my stupid mic. Let me bring it closer.
Yes.
Is that any better?
Yes, that is. That's amazing.
Okay, good.
And Ms. Wright, if you could maybe speak a little louder, too.
How's this?
Oh, that's awesome.
All right.
And let's see. So a little bit about us, and I'm making this up as I go. Think of us as like a rap group. Yes, I know conservatives and rap, that's not the first thing that comes to people's mind. But think of us as
no.
CWA. That's conservative attitude. We've got Scary Smart. She could be a Spice Girl, too. Always Right. And Man with a Skin Condition. That would be me.
You're the Prince of White Bread.
All right. And I am, of course, the Prince of White Bread. So, the Right Wing Riot is beginning now. And one of the most, we've got like two important things we want to mock this week. There'll be a lot of free-form sarcasm floating through as well.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we take a look at Hobby Lobby, the Supreme Court, and pretty much the end of liberal Western civilization as we know it.
Yeah.
You know, there were a lot of reactions to that ruling, and even my cat, if you can hear her, was disturbed by it. Some of the reactions were like this.
All the humanity and all the fans have been feeding her.
There were others that were a little more thoughtful, something like this.
Folks agree that this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world.
And then finally, there were those who were just too overcome by emotion.
I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen.
So.
Did you hear the screaming crowds in the background?
Yeah.
Wow.
And That was just before they got the torches and the pitchforks and began to hang all five male Supreme Court justices in effigy.
Yeah, that was like mayhem in the streets out there.
It was. We have to be honest, of course, that this ruling has completely denied women the right to choose, the right to contraception. It is, in fact...
Well, to choose anything. The right to choose anything.
Yeah. They have to all wear burkas now, in fact, because of this ruling.
We don't even have a choice to eat chocolate. We can't eat chocolate now. Because
okay.
chocolate obviously is... Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I think the riot will start. Yeah. So let's talk a little more seriously. Jamie K. Wilson, what did the ruling actually say?
It said that of the 20 or 21 forms of contraception that Hobby Lobby was supposed to provide, that they could opt out of providing four of them.
That is, in fact, crushing women's choice.
Yes.
Poor
I just
because,
need a moment here. I just have to absorb this because I'm really ashamed now to be a man to know that somewhere men are taking all choice away from women.
Well, you know you're supposed to buy us everything, don't you?
If
we want a Porsche. Yeah, go ahead.
I knew that when I was dating. That was understood.
Yeah. When you're married, too, you're supposed to buy us everything.
Wait, you're not supposed to get married. What are you talking about? You don't. The government will take care of you.
No.
You don't get married.
Oh, right.
You get married, so it's easier to get alimony.
Oh, aren't you clever?
Yeah.
If you're too proud to take welfare, take alimony.
You can get welfare too.
Yeah. Okay.
You can get welfare too. You can get all of it.
Wow. Gosh.
That should pay for everything.
I don't know why I even bothered working all those years. Well, but let's go back to
because we're precious flowers. And you have
someone
to nurture us.
You know, I'm just feeling worse all the time now for being a man. Just want to let you all know that.
Well, that's the right thing for you.
I'm becoming enlightened even as we speak, apparently.
Excellent.
So back to the actual ruling. The Supreme Court said that a certain kinds of closely held corporations with a long history of adherence to certain religious beliefs could not be compelled to violate those beliefs to uphold all the tenets of that sacred law known as Obamacare.
Yeah.
Okay. And what's the problem with that for feminists as we understand it?
The problem is the bigger picture, because if you game that out, it means that a Catholic corporation, or owned by Catholics, because obviously corporations are owned by human beings, they can opt out of providing any birth control at all because it offends their faith. And you can extrapolate that to many other things.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Let's extrapolate, but first... I'm hearing some background noise there. Does somebody have a radio on? Or
I don't know what that is. It's not me.
It's the NSA. Damn them.
Yeah,
they're not even giving us their full attention.
That's insulting.
What I found interesting, and I found this interesting for a long time, especially when Sandra Fluke, that would be the martyr Sandra Fluke, whose life has been ruined and wrecked ever since she dared stand up to the man and speak truth to power. And don't we all wish we could be so ruined with her speaking fees? When she was talking about women's right to birth control and contraception, being the Neanderthal that I am, I was pondering the Constitution, and actually, to quote a libertarian feminist, she said, "I must have missed birth control the last time I was reading through the Constitution." Birth control, the right to choose, that's an implied right. While, oddly, the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, is rather explicitly stated, wouldn't you say, riot girls?
Indeed, but the explicitly stated things seem to be overruled now by a lot of implicit things.
Yep.
Okay. I think we can go back to that. Well, carrying on that line of reasoning, it seemed to me that if Sandra Fluke, in her poverty and impoverishment at that very expensive university, thought somebody else should pay for her birth control, I wondered if she'd be okay with paying for my ammunition. Because I have a right to keep and bear arms, so why shouldn't she have to pay for my right?
I agree.
You know, I think Sandra was supposed to be on the show today, wasn't she?
No one
would pay her cab fare, though, so she couldn't make it.
Ooh.
But
okay, I need a new sound effect for burn. But, okay, we'll get back to that. I mean, there's a lot. It seems to me there's a lot of ways that folks don't want to acknowledge that we respect the rights, or let me rephrase that the rights of some religions are respected, if not cowered to. For instance, my thought was to my Jewish friends who would have stopped talking to me, was I have a right to purchase and consume bacon.
Yeah.
But if I went to a kosher deli and demanded they serve me bacon, should they have to?
Well, that's another, if you extrapolate out from this Hobby Lobby decision, I'm going to say no.
Correct. Agreed. But if we take the side of the impoverished feminist everywhere who can't afford birth control, why should I then be able to, because it's my right. It is my right, and by golly, their religion doesn't matter. You know, I could go into a black Muslim cafe and say, give me bacon. And if we're going to logically, and it gives that logic and principle thing which breaks down on the left-hand side of the spectrum, logically they should have to serve me bacon if we're going to go with the sort of things that our liberal friends are suggesting about the end of the world. That,
well, you would think that would be the case, but you are adhering to a faith, a Christian faith, if you eat bacon, and that one is actually not protected. So, no, nobody has to accommodate you.
Indeed. However, it just seems to me that if we're going to go with the, it doesn't matter what people's beliefs are, I have a right to something, and you're going to give it to me, which
right.
is right. But again,
right.
then we're talking about principle.
Really, if you're an agnostic or an atheist, you have just as much right to bacon as a Christian does. And I don't care. I don't care if you're a Jewish deli. You need to be serving that to me. That's really what it comes down to.
Yeah.
But as a matter of fact, somebody in line should buy it for me because I have the right to that bacon.
And that is also implied, of course, in the Constitution, your right to the bacon.
Uh-huh. Sure. Absolutely.
That's
so
the 42nd amendment?
I think there should have been an amendment for bacon. Bacon's important. It's tasty stuff. You can add it to anything, and it's better.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So if we wrap birth control pills in bacon, everybody would be happy.
You might find a lot of guys with strange symptoms all of a sudden.
Oh, dear.
Well, it would be one explanation. All right. Let's see. I've done a lot of chatting. Ladies, right, girls, as it were. Actually, in all honesty, you are women. You probably have a little more of a dog in this fight. What are your thoughts on it? I can only mock so far because I'm a man and I really, have no standing. But go on.
As a feminist, I insist that I am cared for by others, and so this ruling is devastating. Devastating to me. I don't know.
And how will you cope, Ms. Always Right? How will you cope with the fact you're not being taken care of, and it is your right to be taken care of?
Well, there's going to be a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth. I'll probably have to have multiple pregnancies and go on welfare, I guess. What else am I going to do? It's not like I can go to the store and buy.
I can't talk, baby.
It's
a settlement.
Well, see, that's what happened to me. That's what happened to me. That's why I've got 5 kids, because I could not get somebody else to buy my birth control for me.
Well, you are a most impressive feminist, and I admire you greatly.
I suffer for the cause, hon.
Good girl.
Wow, I just got nothing to say here on this one.
All I can think of is
you know, just how much my vasectomy scar itches sometimes.
But it's the stupidest thing. Go out and buy your own. You can buy it over the counter. You can buy it through a doctor. You can buy it in a box. You can buy it with a box. Pay for the stuff. It doesn't cost that much, and it's a lot cheaper than a baby.
Oh, yes.
I mean, come on.
No, it's embarrassing as a woman to be, you know, treated as, well, I'm too stupid. Yeah,
it is.
Yes, I don't know who these women are who say that sort of thing, but they really make us look bad.
Okay, Scary Smart is starting to foam and froth a little bit. Tell us more about how it's embarrassing and insulting, Scary Smart.
It's exactly what Kia said. I don't want to be condescended to. I don't want to be treated as one part of my body. That's the least important part of my body. I happen to be a woman. I also happen to be a writer and a leader and a smart person and a mom and a wife and a sister and a friend to a lot of people. I mean, come on, that's... For the most part, that part of my life is limited to me and my husband. I don't need to share it with anybody else, and nobody needs to interfere with it. They don't need to tell me what not to do, and they don't need to buy anything for that part of my body.
No, you're mistaken. It actually is your boss's responsibility, and it's his business. Okay.
Apparently.
Yeah, so you're mixing that
every time. Every morning when I get late, should I go in and report to my boss? Oh, wait, I am my boss. It doesn't matter.
You could just drop me an email just to keep me informed.
Oh, please. You probably know too much already.
Oh,
dear.
I'm always willing to learn, but I digress. So, you know, the reactions of feminists of, you know, the, let me... Maybe we should clarify the progressive feminist, the liberal, leftist, socialist, neo-communist feminist.
I just call them crazy women.
They're very hysterical and bossy.
And that's an acronym for something, I'm sure. But it sounds so contrary to the whole to the way it sort of started. Again, obviously it was an upper-class, white, affluent woman sort of reaction in a lot of ways in the 60s, saying basically, you know, accept us as complete and full partners in society and humanity in our relationships. And to devolve from that to the whole stompy foot, you must give me things, it seems like a real change from where it began.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say they're really just playing to the third wave feminists, because the third wave feminists are kind of all about sex. So
third
they're playing to their new audience. Yeah, the first wave feminists were the Elizabeth Cady Stanton's. Second wave was what we had in the third wave feminists. If you go out and read things by like Amanda Marcotte and people like that, those people are obsessed with sex. They are completely obsessed with it. Once in a while they'll mention economics or something like that, or, you know, be shrill about how evil the Republicans are. But for the most part, it's all about having sex, having more sex, having how you dress sexy and don't get raped. Oh, my God, those people are evil for even thinking about raping us, even though we're wearing practically nothing in high heels. You know, those people. That's what they talk about. And so, really, I think a large part of this whole war on women, because everybody won't buy us contraceptives thing, I really think that's playing to that third wave crowd.
Do we think that this is going to start being as obviously stupid to everyone as it is to us?
Dear God, I hope so.
I mean, how long can they keep saying this with a straight face and have everyone nodding along?
Well, I think as long as they've got the buy-in of their cliques of people from New York City, from Washington, D.C., the folks who, by and large, haven't done anything except go to college, say the right things, go to the right parties, and get the right jobs. Maybe not, but with the Internet, I believe we can spread it around. We can start to spread the truth, speak truth to power. And wait a minute.
There it was.
That that reminds me, let's talk about the new counterculture. Because the old counterculture, the one that was in the 60s, was, Ms. Always Right, you know a little bit about copywriting and advertising and things of that nature. In the 60s, the counterculture was peddled as speaking proof to power.
Yep.
You know, sticking it to the man.
Exactly.
When in truth, a lot of it was just about let's do what we want and nobody's going to tell us otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And since the 60s, all the revolutionaries have become the man themselves, what I call the new man.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, there's a need for a new counterculture because there's the new man. The new man who's telling us what to do, ignoring the laws. We won't mention any names, Barack Obama. And, in fact, being everything they despise, but because their hearts are pure, I guess it's okay. So we need a new counterculture. Scary Smart Jimmy K. Wilson, let's talk about that.
Oh, okay. You want me to just lead into this cold? All right, I see. I see what we're doing.
I couldn't segue any more than that. I'm sorry.
Okay, all right. Well, you know, it's a new man same as the old man, right? There's
mm-hmm.
not any difference. Mm-hmm. It's just that they have a different list of things on their little marker board. That's it. New counterculture is really all about individuals taking the freedom of the press into their own hands. Amazon really started it. Amazon started by allowing people to publish their own books for practically no money and sell it directly to whoever they wanted to sell it to and make anywhere from 35% to 70% off of the list price.
And how beautiful is that? Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, my God.
To this day, I think that's so beautiful. So free market and smart.
Yes.
Sorry, go on.
Let me give you a little perspective. Back in the 1920s, 1930s, writers made typically 30 to 35% off of every book sale. That's off of print books. They cost money to print, they cost money to distribute, and they cost money to the booksellers, or, you know, to give to booksellers. But they were making 30% off of the price of the book. And they were whining about it. They wanted to make more. Fast forward that to the 1980s, 1990s, when the big bookseller or the big book publishers were firmly in control. They might, if you were a really big, important writer, give you 20% of the cover price, 20%. More likely, you were going to get about 4 to 6%.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. That's a huge drop. Well, Amazon really has just reverted to the old model, cut out all those expenses of printing and distribution, and they're giving you the 35% again or 70% depending on, you know, how you're selling with them. That's a huge difference. That's possibly the most freeing model in publishing I can think of right now,
exactly.
Just the way they're doing
exactly.
it.
Okay. So A lot more people now have access to a platform to express their ideas.
Absolutely anybody. That's the other thing. The old publishers acted as gatekeepers. They decided what you were going to read. And mostly they were friends back in the 30s, go all the way back there again, with people around the Algonquin table, like Hemingway and Dorothy Parker. And those are the people they published. Now, don't worry that there were really great writers in, like, Omaha, Nebraska, or, well, there were, you know, Omaha, Nebraska,
absolutely, yeah.
BF, Texas, or wherever. The people that got published were the people who were in New York who hung out with the publishers because they got to know them, they read their stuff, they edited their stuff, they helped each other, and they got published. And they got famous. And they changed the face of literature. Well, when more people started to catch on to the fact that New York was where it was at, they started sending more and more manuscripts in there. Today, I think like 99.9% of all manuscripts are rejected by the big publishers. It's a huge number.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. They can pick and choose. They can slant fiction any direction they want to slant it. And they've been
mostly
slanting
they're slanting in the boring direction.
The boring or the teeth gnashing, chest hair pulling out stuff, you know, the misery stuff. I don't want to hear about miserable stuff. I want to hear about heroes. I don't care about the other people.
Very miserable.
But what they did is they slanted everything toward liberalism. Let's just face it. And a few years ago, I got sick and tired of romance books that bashed Sarah Palin for absolutely no reason. No, had nothing to do with the story. They just say something nasty about Sarah Palin. It was like the fifth one I'd read in a month, and I was sick of it.
That's how you know the writer is smart.
What happened? Oh, because she plays to the editor? Yeah, smart for that model. But smart for that model. She was smart for that model because she was playing to the editor. She wasn't playing to the reader. Amazon plays to the reader. And that's what makes them completely different. So what's been happening is suddenly a lot of conservative writers and libertarian writers have found out, hey, I've got a place I could publish my manuscripts. And smart people are catching on to it, like Adam Bellow at Liberty Island, and they're looking for writers that they can develop who are of the conservative and libertarian bent. And we're creating a new counterculture. We're going to change it. We're going to change the whole face of publishing.
Well, it's about time. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more. What do you think the new counterculture should do, Riot Girl?
I've talked.
Same as always, right? Tell us what you think the new counterculture should be trying to accomplish.
It should be trying to fill the massive, gigantic, glaring hole in the market for all of us who are tired, as you say, of reading about how stupid Sarah Palin is or how stupid we are in our fiction. There's probably half the country at least turned off from current culture, including fiction. You know, there's probably fewer readers when you're talking about, especially young people. They just give up because it's so monotonous and tedious and leftist and not fun to read. So that's what I think the new counterculture should be doing, is serving these people. So it's wonderful. It's a very market-oriented movement. And also being the counterculture, it's the only creative movement right now that has genuine energy behind it and genuine, what's the word I'm looking for? We certainly have the moral upper hand at this point. We're fighting against the machine.
Yeah, absolutely. We're the rebels.
Yep.
Which
is you can't fake that. You can't fake that.
It's interesting to me. I think it's a truism, and I'm paraphrasing someone, but it occurred to me is that it seems that there's a sort of life cycle of any large organization, which is, it starts with a purpose or a mission, and at a certain point, it becomes so big it loses sight of the mission and becomes obsessed with preserving its existence.
Yeah.
Yep.
So a lot of the things, actually, one could say, in the counterculture of the 60s were really valid and important, right? Civil rights.
Absolutely.
Women's rights. But, as, you know, one, you look at civil rights, quote, leaders of today, and it's people like Jesse Jackson, who had a mistress on the payroll of the Rainbow Coalition and was paying her money.
Completely corrupt, man. Yeah.
Right. Hal Sharpton, this guy's got a national, although smallly, you know, slightly viewed, show on MSNBC. This guy's a charlatan and a huckster. He libeled a guy, accusing this guy of being part of a rape, which was a fake rape.
Oh, he ruins lives. He gets people killed, and somehow he has a television show.
Right.
Yeah.
And so maybe these guys, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that perhaps they began with actual pure motives and they weren't egomaniacal race hustlers.
Yeah.
But now they've turned into it's about what they can get. You only have to look at the horrible Trayvon Martin incident to see they were down there as soon as they could find some allegedly, quote, white person who had shot a poor black kid.
I always
They're
have
down
a
there marching and rioting.
I have a theory that they heard George Zimmerman's name before they saw him, and they were like, yes, that's the one we're going to promote now. And then they got down there and found out he was a white Hispanic. It kind of was a monkey wrench.
Yeah.
I think they're finding out the name.
When we never see these same two fellas marching to protest all the young black men killed by other young black men because there's no money in it for them.
Mm-hmm.
But it
is like you say, and with publishing too, they've outlived their usefulness. They're just sort of self-preservation oriented now.
Yeah.
I see. All right. So if we were to write a manifesto for the new counterculture, I'll give you a minute to think about it. All kind of things. I know we're going to change the culture now in 30 seconds, but wait, Igor has something to say. Igor says, now, time's up. Let's write a manifesto for the new counterculture. What sort of things should that new counterculture be trying to accomplish?
Bringing out truth.
Yep.
Ooh, okay.
Telling the truth.
Thank you.
That's what the 60s was supposed to be about, speaking truth. We need to speak truth and we need to find truth. We need to bring it out.
Mm-hmm. And reality, too. Yeah. The two are linked. There's a big war on reality now. So.
Ah.
Yeah.
You know, it's, yes, there certainly is. Well, it's so much fun. You can look at a lot of the things they said in the 60s, and you want to throw it right back in the old hippies' faces.
Oh, yeah, like, for instance, that Truesbury comic strip that's been going around. It does exactly that. I think it uses their own words right against them. Yeah.
Wait, tell me more about this Truesbury.
Truesbury is just a devastating satirical take on the horrible old Doonesbury comic strip, which, as you recall, was not really ever funny. I don't know why it was on the comics pages of the paper, even as a child. I was like, what is this doing here? Basically, it was a partisan screed. And the very funny thing that the Truesbury strip does is take the old Doonesbury strips and just change the names. So they'll change President Nixon to President Obama. And it fits perfectly. It fits like a glove. But you will never see Gary Trudeau or anyone else creating that comic strip today because they are hypocrites and can't admit that it's worse today than what they used to protest.
Golly.
Gary Trudeau. Gary Trudeau retired this year because he didn't have anything else to say.
Yeah. Maybe he realized that if he was going to still speak truth to power, he would have to tear himself in two or something.
Mm-hmm.
Golly. Okay, so part one of the countercultural manifesto is read Truesbury.
I guess.
Yeah. Or as
sure.
We say, we have to actually speak the truth.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to borrow something that I'm swiping, actually, from Glenn Reynolds, the Insta Pundit. He points out that liberals are always interested in sort of the higher truth that serves the revolution, as opposed to boring bourgeoisie truth, which has to do with facts.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're going to speak the boring bourgeoisie truth, which has...
I didn't know there was more than one. Who knew that?
Well,
it's
that's because we are cultural dupes, to borrow a Marxist term.
Mm-hmm.
That's the name of my band, by the way, in case anybody's wondering.
Excellent.
Yeah, it used to be the Rhythm Dyslexics, but nobody showed up on time for rehearsal. So,
that's
But I digress.
Nice.
So we want to. The new counterculture has obviously got to speak the truth.
And it has to demand the truth.
Demand the truth.
Yes.
From who, Scary Smart Jimmy
K. Wilson? Everybody. Both sides. I hold them both accountable at this point.
Oh, so you're talking about that that capitalist ancient concept of principle.
Yeah, that would be a good thing to talk about, yeah.
Oh, you mean bigotry and racism.
Oh,
principle.
Well, yeah.
Come on. That word is fallen by the wayside.
Well, all right. So we'll come back to the new counterculture in the coming weeks, and I think we should be on the lookout for examples of it. And I think actually Ms. Always Right has a few she'll toss in later. But I wanted to talk about this. By golly, Igor says. He says it's a segue. What are some of the new bastions of the counterculture? Scary Smart Jamie K. How about telling us about Liberty Island?
I believe Jamie K. aren't they having some kind of a drive right now?
Yes, we are trying to raise a actually rather small amount of funds compared to how everybody else is funded these days. Just to get things to run better. We're not going to go away no matter what. We're committed to that. But we would like to have a better website. We would like to be able to pay our writers better. We would like to be able to get our voice out there a little bit better so everybody knows what we're doing. And what we're doing is, like I was saying, changing the culture. We are looking for and developing conservative and libertarian writers who have genuine storytelling skill. Unfortunately, what we found is that when you put people like that, people like us, into most college programs, they get ignored, they get shunted aside, their voices get shut out. The liberal professors who are running creative writing programs don't like to hear from them, they don't like to develop them. They give them bad grades, as I've seen this happen. And they get silenced. They give up. They're like, well, you know what? What's the point? Nobody's going to publish me anyway.
Right.
I'm never going to make any money on this, so I'm just going to go to business school. And so that's what they all do. They all go to business school.
Is that what happened? Because I always thought conservatives just weren't creative and weren't able to write or create anything entertaining.
Well, yeah, I've heard that myth. Yeah.
Conservatives.
You mean they've been discouraged? I can't believe that.
Yeah. Conservatives are boring, and they don't like sex. And
that's right.
No.
That's why they don't bother paying for birth control, because you shouldn't be having sex.
Hey, you know what? That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that before.
Okay. Take that to heart, Katie.
Yeah, there you go. Well, they were probably all the result of rape, you know?
No. Oh, okay. Is there any other kind of sex? My goodness.
Apparently there isn't, according to some feminists. But
yeah.
Again,
Andrew
that's the digression.
Poor nutty feminist, yeah. That's
anyway, about
feeling.
That Liberty Island drive, where can people go to contribute to that and help it happen and be part of the counterculture?
The easiest thing to do right now is go to libertyislandmag.com and just click on the link that they've got there. But, you know, I seem to remember that Shrewsbury also has a link. So if you wanted to look up Shrewsbury, you could probably click on the link right there and go to Liberty Island's fundraising drive as well.
So where would people find that Shrewsbury?
Isn't that on right wing? Yeah. What was the URL for that?
Okay. Well, Shrewsbury could be found for now, temporarily, at roymgriffiths.com.
Do you know where I get my Shrewsbury fix? I follow you on Twitter. I follow the Prince of White Bread on Twitter, and you tweet all of those regularly as well as other important countercultural information. So I never miss a strip because I follow the Prince of White Bread on Twitter.
Yep.
One does what one can. but very soon, Shrewsbury will be appearing exclusively, dare I say it, at rightwingriot.com.
Oh,
and scary smart Jamie K. Wilson, who is also a goddess of the web, when will that be up and live?
As soon as you want to talk to me about forwarding things over and as soon as we have a banner for it. Those are the only two things we need. I've got everything together for it.
Well, sounds like there's going to be some emails flying back and forth later today.
It does.
Very close now.
Well, you know, one of the thank you for that. We'll do some more random plugging later.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the hallmarks, it's almost a trademark of the counterculture, especially during the time of the Vietnam War, was protest. You know, people were protesting the war. They were doing sit-ins. They were having smoke-ins, and what was it? The Yippies ran Pegasus. For president, and they tried to levitate the Pentagon. So is the new counterculture doing anything similar? Ms. Always Right?
This is where I think that conservatives do
Oh, my
Excuse
God.
Me. I did not mean to talk over him. I'm sorry. This is
Igor,
where I
Igor's
think
very
conservatives do have a genuine personality trait that makes it hard for us to do things like protest. First of all, most of us have day jobs, so we're not available to go and pitch a tent city somewhere. And second of all, we are polite and we observe right and wrong and decent treatment of one another. And it's very hard to go to somebody's house and scream at their children and scare them when you're a conservative. You don't really hold with that sort of behavior. So That's difficult for us to protest. My daydream is for all of us to go and protest the media outlets. I think that would be the funniest thing if they had to, if all the reporters had to run the gauntlet of protesters, and all of us could insist, as Jamie says, they would tell the truth, just tell the truth. And the funniest thing would be they would run the gauntlet of all the protesters to get into their studios and probably not report on the protests.
That would be almost certainly the case. But I was thinking there is actually an insurrection going on right now against liberal policies. And could you tell us a little more about that? Ms. Always Right.
Are you referring perhaps to what's going on in California right now with the
I am indeed.
Mass immigration? I'm sorry. Yeah,
yes.
Okay. Yeah, from what I understand, if people are finally starting to... Sorry?
It's not mass. It's not mass immigration. It's mass trespassing.
It's an invasion. Yes, that's another way of putting
it.
It is.
Let's make sure we call it right.
It's an invasion. They're not wearing uniforms. They are not carrying guns, but they are invading
right.
the country with
right.
our president's blessing and with Democrats helping them every step of the way. And, yeah, people are starting to protest, and these are the normal, everyday working people that I was talking about that don't usually do this because we're not able. We're actually being productive members of society. But it's just getting to the point, the lawlessness in this country now, where normal people are starting to protest. And one very effective, targeted thing they've been doing in there's a town in California, I think called Marietta or something, and they're blocking the busloads of illegal immigrants from being deposited in their town where these people will become their responsibility.
Yep.
And I'm really encouraged to see that.
I am, and I did call it an insurrection for very specifically because what we have, in my opinion, is we have the government not following the laws that were passed by Congress and scooping up, first they're not enforcing the border, which of course makes me a racist, and I just want to let you know I'm putting on my Klan hood right now, so I feel comfortable.
As long as you know that.
Yes. You know, they're not enforcing the racist laws by securing the border. And then, as you said, they're interestingly shipping, they're transshipping, they're outsourcing their illegal invasion problem to local municipalities.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's see, the government isn't fulfilling its duty to enforce the law and make the country secure, and then it's making other states pay for the upkeep of the invaders.
Correct. That's what they do. They're especially doing it to Texas. I know that Texas was upset because they still have all of the refugees from Katrina, too. All of the people that the government moved there after that hurricane are still basically on the dole in Texas. And now being a border state, they're getting all these illegal immigrants as well, all these new dependents. And I think they're going to hit the breaking point soon with this. And I do also, by the way, think that is intentional because Texas is a very recalcitrant state. They are not part of the new order. They do not cooperate. So I think they're being sapped with all of these dependents.
Well, okay. Now, so you think it's the conscious decision. I have some thoughts on that. Could you tell us some more about that?
No, basically, absolutely it's a conscious decision. Well, you know what it reminds me of? Do you recall, I think it was in 2009, there was Tony Blair's speechwriter in England basically admitted that it was the Labour Party's plan to import mass immigration to pretty much dilute the culture of England. I actually had some good articles about this. An article written by Tom Whitehead said the huge increases in migrants over the last decade were partly due to a politically motivated attempt to radically change the country. He said Labour's relaxation of controls was a deliberate plan to open up the UK to mass migration, but the ministers were nervous and reluctant to discuss the move publicly for fear it would alienate the working class vote. So as a result, the public argument concentrated instead on economic benefits and the need for more migrants. Now, we've all heard that before, right?
Yes, we have.
But then according to another very good article by Melanie Phillips, which was in the Mail Online, she said, was it not inadvertent at all, or was it deliberate? The latter explanation just seemed too outrageous. After all, a deliberate policy of mass immigration would have amounted to nothing less than an attempt to change the very makeup of this country without telling the electorate. There could not have been a more grave abuse of the entire democratic process. And then she said also that the labor, it's a concealed monumental shift of policy. And it's a way of changing a country without getting people to vote for it.
Well, you know, one of the problems with something like this in America, it's been the same problem that people have encountered with Obamacare, is one has to have standing to sue the government to say what you're doing is wrong. You have to make a case that you've been impacted. Now, what I haven't researched this, but it occurred to me how interesting it is that a lot of it's happening in Arizona and California, which I believe are under the 9th District Court, which is the most liberal court. So anybody who had standing to sue would be shut down. So it's, again, to borrow the 60s Marxist kinds of terms, it'd be a cooling out period. There'd be enough legal impediments to people changing the law that they'd continue to be able to pack immigrants in, these invaders, as it were, in without having legal recourse to stop it. And I believe the populace, the great unwashed, know this. And that's one reason we're starting to see the protests. They're going,
I think so, too. I think that the progressives are trying to rake them in with both hands right now as quick as they can because they know that every single one they can get here, we're just going to have a hell of a time getting rid of again. Mm-hmm. And they can use every single one of them. They're not human beings. They are political poker chips to them. And it's disgusting.
Yeah. To hell with the children that die in the deserts or the ones that get raped or the ones that get shunted off into sexual slavery somewhere in Texas.
Yeah, whatever.
You know, who cares about those?
Yeah, and it's A-OK to work with human traffickers to accomplish the glorious the glorious purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's disgusting.
Now.
I mean, when you think about it, it's very scary because the people running the country do not see human beings, and that never works out well.
Yeah.
We've seen that in revolutionary Russia when they became kulaks and cockroaches and enemies of the people.
Oh, I am reading the most incredible manuscript right now, which talks about that and brings it home like you can't believe. It's not published yet. I have access to this manuscript, though. It's book two in the By the Hands of Men series. You might be familiar with it, Griff. It's amazing historical fiction. And
I think Jamie mentioned it to me once.
Yeah. It's pretty good.
So if anyone wants to get ready for book two to come out, because it the descriptions of what goes on after the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, it's hair-raising and very familiar-sounding in some ways. It is the sequel to the original By the Hands of Men book, which I have already read, and that one is available, and it's a great book.
But we digress.
Sorry.
All right. Well, gosh. So what can we do? Because we don't want to leave our listeners hopeless. What do you think we can do to continue the insurrection against the federal government, not only usurping the rights of the states, but ignoring the Congress and their own laws?
Nothing is easy.
No. You have to sacrifice for everything. I have a list of things that they can do.
Oh, please.
They can. Take time out to go to Tea Party protests. Any protests you hear about, take a little bit of time. If you can get there, go. By all means, take your kids.
Jamie?
Take friends. Yeah.
Could you get a little closer to your mic there? I want to make sure everybody hears that clearly.
What in the world? Okay. Yeah, if you hear of any protests anywhere near you, go. Take your family, take your friends, take your dogs, go to the protest. The more bodies show up, the more they have to listen to it, the more likely it is to be covered. Write op-eds to your paper. Write to your congressman. Let them know how you feel. Don't hesitate to do this. When you're getting ready to go vote, call around to your friends. See if you can find like-minded people who need a ride, who need, you know, some excuse to go vote. Make it into a party, you know, go vote and then have lunch with everybody.
People
will be more likely to go and vote if you make it into something fun. If voting's not fun, you got to stand in line, you got to look at the people that give you dirty looks, and you got to vote, and you got to go.
Yeah.
But, you know, you could even make up a tip sheet for who to vote for, you know, who's lying and who's not lying. Who's going to be really better for what you and your friends want and who's not. You know?
Right.
Just get creative with it. Do the things that will move your beliefs forward.
Yeah. Speak up. Speak up.
I'm trying.
No, I meant that's
what right on top of me.
Do. That's what
oh.
We do.
Oh, okay.
And it, as I say, it is difficult for conservatives. We want to live our own lives and go about our business.
Yeah.
And it's very hard for us to break out of our daily routine of going to work and earning money for ourselves so we can buy our own birth control and so forth to take the time out to go do this. And it's difficult. We don't like confrontation. But unfortunately, something needs to be done.
Confrontation is being thrust upon us, whether we like it or not.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whether you would or no, as Tolkien said.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I hope, Jamie, you would put that up on rightwingriot.com. And also...
just a tip sheet? Sure.
Yeah, and Ms. Always Right, I would love to see a little something with your links up there as well.
Okay.
I think that would be very helpful. And let's see. Well, golly, we've trod over a lot of ground today. Igor the Elephant is very happy to have been part of the show. And just to go over a few things, we have Jamie's tip sheet, which we'll be seeing soon at rightwingriot.com, ways that you can make your voice heard. Another couple of countercultural tidbits for the new counterculture. If you want to stick it to the new man, that would be the Hillary Clintons of the world.
Sorry.
Obviously want to take a look at libertyislandmag.com. That's all one word, Liberty Island Mag. But also, interestingly, this is evidence of how the new counterculture is leaking through. Check out BuzzFeed today.
Oh, yeah.
BuzzFeed has a list of 21 conservative novels you would actually like to read at the beach. Does anybody else have a little more information on that?
I have a little bit more. Yeah, it's written by this amazing man named Adam Bellow, who is a longtime New York editor. He's one of the evil people, except he's not. He's been working with conservatives since the late 1980s. He helped people like Dinesh D'Souza and Jonah Goldberg get their stories out, get their voices heard. And right now, he is the head honcho at LibertyIslandMag.com and the Liberty Island media in general. So he's definitely somebody to listen to when you're talking about conservative fiction.
And you know what else is great about that article is that whenever we talk about conservative fiction, people always say, oh, what are some good books to read? And then you go,
there you go.
It's about time someone published a list. And it's just a start. It's only 21 authors. But this is what we need more of. Where do I go to find this wonderful countercultural fiction?
This is only the first of many.
Excellent.
Awesome.
So everyone should go to BuzzFeed. Check that out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so BuzzFeed, LibertyIslandMag.com, Truesberry, which, again, you will soon find on RightWingRiot.com exclusively. And let's see, I think that's about all for this week, ladies. Riot girls, you have anything else you want to add? Anything we haven't pounded into the ground?
I think that a movie called Persecuted is coming out on July 18th, and that's another one that is from our side. And I haven't seen it yet, but it looks like an exciting thriller. And it's standing up for people like us. For once, you can go to the movies and not be insulted and told you're stupid and backward and bigoted. Rather, you can be the hero in the movie. And I'm very excited about it. And I'm also more excited that as these films come out now, they are able to find distribution. So it used to be that I could never see a conservative film when it came out. Now I have my choice of theaters that are an easy drive from my house. So I'm really happy to see the infrastructure up.
Outstanding. I also recently saw the film Heaven is for Real.
How was that?
It was actually, it was very enjoyable. It was not nearly as heavy-handed as some other Christian-themed films I've seen. It was directed by Randall Wallace, who's directed some really fine films, among them We Were Soldiers, which is a great Vietnam movie. So I would recommend that.
I can't go see that because I think it'll make me cry.
Yeah.
I can't do it. Sorry.
All right. Well, it was a lovely film.
I'm sure it is, and I recommend it because no one has said anything bad about it. But too hard for me. Once you have kids, you're ruined for a lot of stuff.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
Scary smart, anything else?
I think I'll hold on to anything else I've got for next week. We're kind of running short, so.
All right. Well,
we
will touch on some other things next week. I'm hoping we'll get to Hillary Clinton, really poor, or just a really poor liar. Among the other exciting things we're going to do. So I think that is the end of our show for this week. And I'm looking for my audio clip desperately. And
whenever you're ready, you can take us out. Whenever you're ready. And don't forget to press the end program button.
I was just getting ready to say that.
I beat
the big red button. Yeah, you did.
End. Okay, now I've got to find that. Well, anyway, thank you very much, everyone, for joining us today. Thank
we can't
you,
leave.
Ryan,
we can never get out.
For keeping me on track.
We're out of time for today's Riot. You can find us on the web at rightwingriot.com. No hyphen, all one word, Right Wing Riot. Thanks to our generous internet radio host, Daria Ann DiGiovanni.